that we lost him again. Fascinating phenomenon he was explaining about prediction markets and what he calls the gamification of war. Now, happily in the studio, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover have joined us because they're up next. What have you got in store for tremulous listeners?
The tremulous listeners. Well, we're going to try and make you... What would be the point at which you'd pass tremulous? We're going to talk about the Middle East, and we're going to invite your questions either of a domestic and financial nature, which can be answered by Dominic O'Connell, or of a political and geopolitical nature, which can be answered by Richard Spencer. So it's all over to you, dear listeners, if you'd like to send us a little message. No question too big or too small, Jane.
100%.
And you're talking about Opus Dei as well, the Catholic movement.
We are, yeah. Yep. We're talking to the journalist who had that quite long conversation with the Pope about the allegations against Opus Dei, which, by the way, they deny.
They do.
That's all coming up. So I think it's what you call a mixed bag, Mark.
Yeah. So, well, I'm sure people will tune in and... that's what keeps the money coming in. From me, Mark Urban, thank you very much. We'll be back tomorrow.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Mark, thank you very much. Mark is back with The Times at 1 tomorrow. This is Jane Garvey and Fee Glover with you until 4. And for any goldfish listening, what have we got on the programme, Fee?
Well, I'm going to do it formally now. We'll have our Q&A on the conflict in the Middle East with our two experts. There is still time to get your questions, and you can WhatsApp us, 0333 003 2353. We will be joined by the journalist accusing Opus Dei of covering up sexual crimes. After 3.30 as well today, our big interview looks at the issues that arise when children's homes are privatised.
And let's have the news now at 2 o'clock.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. The Health Secretary is playing down concerns meningitis could spread across the country, saying the risk is low. 20 cases are confirmed in Kent, where two people have died. Meningitis B vaccines will be offered to all students living on the University of Kent's Canterbury campus from today. Times Radio's Amelia Beltrow reports.
The UK Health Security Agency did declare a national incident on Sunday, but that was an operational move, meaning they could move more antibiotics to Kent. It also allowed them to bring in staff to help with a localised vaccination programme, which is due to start this afternoon.
Pharmacies are running out of the meningitis B vaccine as thousands of parents rush to pay for their children to get the jab privately. Wes Streeting, the health secretary, reassured the public it was not necessary to buy privately. At PMQ's, Kemi Badenoch repeatedly asked the Prime Minister whether or not he spoke to Peter Mandelson before hiring him as trade envoy to the US.
This was my mistake in making the appointment, and I've apologised to the victims of Epstein. I do so again. It's clear the appointment process wasn't strong enough, and that's why I've already strengthened it. But it was my mistake, Mr. Speaker, and I've apologised for it. She should follow suit and apologise for a gross error of judgment in calling for the UK to join the war in Iran without thinking through the consequences.
Times Radio's Lara Spirit was confused by Starmer's reluctance to tackle the question.
Our colleague Patrick Maguire has noted that Number 10 has, on the record, acknowledged that they didn't have this conversation. So the fact that he's refusing to answer it is completely bizarre. Like, Number 10 has literally already admitted this.
That is odd. Yet,
and if he had said in the first question, for example, you know, we've said this before, this conversation, blah, 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 then it wouldn't have made as much room for a second and a third question on this.
And a fourth.
Meanwhile, an Iranian missile has hit a vital airbase housing British and Australian personnel in the United Arab Emirates. Elsewhere, Israel's claimed to have killed Iran's Minister of Intelligence, and Qatar has condemned an Israeli attack on an Iranian facility on the Gulf Coast, serving a massive gas field it shares with Doha. Former Reigate MP Crispin Blunt has been charged with drug offences, including possession of Class A and Class B substances. It follows a police visit to his home in 2023 in relation to a separate matter. Gerry Adams was a major, major player in the war, according to one of his former friends who was an IRA volunteer at the High Court. Brendan Hughes says the words during a recorded interview that was played in court to Mr. Adams. The former Sinn Féin president denies the allegations against him by three victims of bombings in England by the provisional IRA in the 1970s and 90s. And the government is preparing to sue former Chelsea owner Roman Abramovich for not releasing the £2.5 billion received from selling the club to support victims in Ukraine. It's believed Abramovich wants the money to go to victims of the war on both sides. The Prime Minister's spokesperson says he has failed to make the donation he committed to. And remember, the finest writers from The Times preview and review the week's football on The Game podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Good afternoon. That was Will Hobbs with the news at 2 o'clock. Thank you very much, Will. So we are Jane Garvey and Fee Glover. We're here until 4 o'clock. And you're with Times Radio, and we live in troubled times. So we've booked the Times business correspondent, Dominic O'Connell, and the Times foreign correspondent, Richard Spencer. And between now and about 2:30, you can ask them anything. 0333 003 2353. Dom, you were just saying the oil price has really gone up.
Yeah, just as we were speaking, actually. So we started the day just a fraction over $100 a barrel. We're talking about Brent crude, the benchmark price here. Now, as I look, it's just a fraction under $109. It's a 6% jump on the day, roughly. That is a big one-day move. I think it's because the attacks in Iran on both sides now are moving to oil facilities themselves, yeah, exporting facilities. So that is an extension of the conflict and a further threat to oil and gas supplies.
OK, because Iran has issued this evacuation warning for the facilities in, I'm just looking, Saudi, UAE and Qatar, and told them they're going to be targeted in the coming hours.
They'd already done a bit of that. They attacked a field in Abu Dhabi, the Shah field, yesterday, and a couple of fields in Saudi Arabia have been attacked in the previous couple of days. But this sounds like a much more formal sort of escalation that these are now in the frame.
OK, back to you and indeed to Richard Spencer in a moment. Also on the programme today, what a British journalist told the Pope about Opus Dei. The journalist called Gareth Gore, and he thinks that there needs to be an independent investigation into the organisation, which he accuses of covering up financial and sexual crimes. We'll appraise PMQs. Did the PM speak directly to Mandelson about his friendship with Epstein before he got that big job in Washington? Well, that's what Kemi Badenoch asked today, but did she get a response? More on that later. We'll talk about the best TV around. And in sport with Vassos, what's happened in that the fiery final of the African Cup of Nations ended in victory for Senegal, but now they've decided Senegal can't have it. Morocco are champions after all, and the Senegalese are suing. So plenty for Vassos to get stuck into at about 3:15. And who's the big guest? A big guest we've got today.
So we have two guests today, Jane. One is Rosie Maguire, who's from the Centre for Thriving Places, and one is Claire Bracey, who is from Become, which helps care experienced children and young people cope with life. And both of them are on to talk about the parlour situation in children's homes, certainly in some parts of the country where privatisation has taken the investment out and left an awful lot of consternation within. I'll just give you a couple of statistics to whet your appetite. Rosie is part of a report that looked into North East, South Yorkshire and West Midlands Combined Authority regions in terms of the amount of money involved by privatised care companies between 2021 and 2024. £45 million was paid out in dividends to shareholders. £256 million of profit was made by companies providing those care services, and directors of the companies were earning up to 60 times more than the average wage, while frontline care workers were often paid below the living wage. I think that gives you an idea as to what's happening, and we're going to look at the impact that that has had on the children who are meant to have been
been looked after, and we're going to take a gander across the horizon to work out what might happen next.
Yeah, really important story. Let's have a look at the most read articles on the Times website so far.
In at number three, Guardian amends anti-Semitic opinion piece about Gail's Bakery. Now, the article by Jonathan Liu was changed to clarify a reference to the Jewish Heritage Company's heavy-handed high street aggression. The second most read story, Trump is furious at Britain over Iran. Here's why. The president has been candid about his dissatisfaction with Keir Starmer for refusing to back him in Iran. For Anglophile Trump, it amounts to betrayal. And the most read piece on the Times website is Grandmother in Malay with off-duty police at bottomless brunch.
I can't imagine why people are flocking to that one today.
The woman and her three daughters were cleared of a fray after the officers acted like territorial and entitled bullies at the high school musical themed event.
But can we just, in our retirement, can we make certain that we are involved at in a melee at a bottomless brunch?
With some off-duty officers, yeah. Please, thrown
please,
into the mix.
Let's do it.
I can understand why people are heading for that headline, because there's an awful lot of gloom and doom in the world, and obviously we don't encourage that kind of behaviour at all.
My goodness, no.
I like a bottom on my brunch.
Thank you very much. Now, we do have obviously some very, very challenging things going on in the world right now. Israel is reporting that it's killed Iran's intelligence minister just a day after the death of the country's security chief. That as news emerges that an Iranian missile hit the UAE, part of the UAE that houses British personnel last night. Donald Trump has continued to voice his disappointment with Keir Starmer over Britain's response to the conflict, or lack of it, you could argue. Meanwhile, airstrikes in Lebanon are escalating. And yes, the impacts are being felt by consumers here in the UK. So you've already heard from Dominic O'Connell, Times Radio business correspondent, and Richard Spencer, Times foreign correspondent, is in Doha. And Richard can also take your questions between now and about 2:30. 0333 003 2353. Richard, how are you today, and what is going on in Doha?
Well, Doha's coming under attack like all the Gulf states is. More bangs overnight as missiles and drones come over. I'm told the number of missiles is actually reducing, but the number of drones is increasing. So you can read that into that what you will. Maybe Iran is running out of missile launchers because they're being attacked so successfully by Israel and America, or maybe they're hiding their missile launchers away, saving them for another day, and using cheaper, easier to operate covertly drones instead. There's a lot of anger in the Gulf generally, as you may have picked up over the last few days, both at America for sort of getting them into this mess, and for and at Iran, particularly at Iran, because countries in the Gulf have been trying to get better relations with Iran recently, in the hope that they would be left out of any conflict that arose between Iran and Israel, and indeed America. Qatar in particular has been a strong mediating factor. In fact, it's come under a lot of attack in America and the West generally for being too friendly to Iran. And yet it's also coming under attack, which is making it very miserable indeed.
Jane wants you, Richard, to tell her what the Iran war is for.
The Iran war is to proceed with the general dismantling of forces in the Middle East that are hostile to America and to Israel, America and perhaps the West more generally. You can see in the short term, this started last year when Israel decided to attack Iran in June and America joined in. The sense that Israel has is that it will never be at peace so long as Iran is using its proxy forces to attack Iran, building up missiles to fire at Israel, using its proxy forces to attack Israel, building up its force in the region like Hezbollah, building up its missiles to attack Israel directly, and of course the million-dollar question that's been hanging over this for two or three decades now of the Iranian nuclear program. What's that for?
Right. Well, sorry to interrupt you, Richard, but another listener, Pam, takes up that point and says, but I still don't understand why now the threat of Iran's nuclear capability has been mentioned on and off for years, she says.
Yeah, well, so the argument that Israel would say is that all attempts to negotiate with Iran over the years have failed. The Iranian nuclear deal was too narrowly focused, in that only focused on the nuclear program, not on the not on the militias, and not on its support for violent anti-Israel organizations. The trigger, if you like, was the October 7th attack by Hamas, which is supported by Iran. And having held off, this is the Israel argument, having held off this sort of direct kinetic attack on Iran, which they regard as the sort of the source of all evil from their point of view, until that moment, and tried to deal with these militias through other means, through sort of proxy negotiations, bringing in America, bringing in Qatar, which is, as I say, a mediator in all these things. October 7th showed that none of that could be, that was all useless. Therefore, they had to take more decisive action. They went after Hezbollah first. Then they were also dealing with Hamas. Once those two targets have been severely weakened, they could then turn to Iran itself.
We're taking the opportunity to open the phone lines really for you this afternoon. So any questions that you have to our two experts, we are 0333 003 2353. Dom, I'm going to round up two questions into one because they're of a similar theme. One comes in from John and one comes in from Paul. Paul says, more an observation than a question, but little has been said about the impact the war has had on pension funds. They have taken a big hit. And John's point is about investments. Having just retired last year, I'm extremely worried and stressed as I've lost nearly £15,000 in 2 weeks. What happens to our investments now? Most people who've got anything invested in the stock market will have seen a drop.
Well, they won't, actually. the FTSE 100 has fallen about 4% this month, but on the year, it's up about 4%.
So why are pension funds down? Because a lot of people say
they are. Well, it depends what they're invested in. I don't think they are. I mean, I'd be interested to know what those pension funds are invested in, but if they're invested in the share market, in the British share market, they're not much down, and the US market hasn't done much either. Asian markets, if they happen to have a pension that has an emerging market fund in it, they may have had a bit more of a beating because emerging markets have taken a bit more of a hit. But overall, your pension should not have suffered if it's a pretty mainstream pension.
Okay, so if you're in one of those stocks and shares, ISAs, or you've got stocks and shares, obviously everybody does, in pensions, is it likely that you could be affected in the future, even if you hadn't been affected now? Would it be a good idea to try and change some things if you can?
Well, I don't want to give financial advice because I think really you should go to a professional for financial advice. Your appetite for risk is everything when it comes to choosing, and diversification is everything as well. I don't know what's going to happen to the stock market tomorrow. One of the features of stock markets in recent years is that they've been very good at ignoring any kind of geopolitical nonsense. In Trump's first term, we had a nuclear showdown with North Korea. Remember that? Stock markets hardly blinked. And the lesson has been, by and large, if you ignore all the nonsense that happens around Trump, you do well. You don't do well by selling. So whether that's going to be the same this time around, I don't know. As I speak, the FTSE 100 is down just under 1% today. That's not a big move. Overall, it's up this year.
Phil does say my pension's down a lot as well. And I've got to say, it's not about me, but my pension's gone down too. I know you shouldn't check it all the time. It's a very dangerous thing to do. But it's been a bit depressing.
I'd be interested to know what your pension is invested in.
Well, you know, it's, everything. a little bit of everything. I've tried to. I'm very risk averse.
I bet you've ticked quite a low risk.
I'm totally medium. Yeah. Okay, so Phil and I need to seek different advice.
Well, I need to join your club as well, Jane.
Okay, right, you see, so there are a few of us. Let's get to some other questions.
The bigger picture is if you're on a defined benefit pension, the outcome can depends upon long assumptions about long-term interest rates. They have been coming down in recent months, but that's nothing to do with the Iran war.
No.
So your annuity may have come down, but that's not to do with recent moves in the stock market. The stock market, by and large, hasn't done much.
All right. What's this question? Georgina, this is for you, Richard. How much of this is down to Putin? It's raised the price of oil. Russia, we know, is making a lot more money, which he obviously needed for the war in Ukraine. Could he have done all this on his own, Putin? What do you say?
I don't think Putin is such a master manipulator that he could manipulate Iran, America, and Israel all into doing his bidding in direct terms. The one thing that your question might be getting at is everyone you speak to anywhere. The one thing that everyone's agreed on is that the winner out of all of this is Russia. The pressure's off over Ukraine. The pressure's off specifically over oil, in that America has lifted some of the restrictions on that it implied through its sanctions regime on Russia selling oil, and wants Europe to do the same, and wants Russia to be able to sell more of its own oil to supplement the stuff that's not getting through the Straits of Hormuz. And in any case, the fact that the oil price has gone up by whatever it is, is it 40% rise in the last few weeks, given that Russia is heavily dependent on oil for its economy sales, it's getting a lot more money. So Russia's done very well out of it. In a sense, you can say this is all part of a broader Russian strategy. It's support for Iran over the last few years, which has been mutual. Iran has given Russia all those Shahid drones for the war in Ukraine, and Russia gives Iran diplomatic backing, vetoes sanctions policies at the UN, vetoes other anti-Iran policies at the UN, and indeed there's clearly been military cooperation as well. You can say that in that sense, Iran is being encouraged to defy the West, defy America and Israel by Putin. Whether he's gamed out all the steps is another matter. But certainly, this is, in the broadest possible context, this is another confrontation in the on-off war between the West and critics of the West, if you want to put it broadly. And those include Iran, Russia, and, of course, China.
John says, can you ask Richard why the Gulf states who've been bombed by Iran are not able to pressurise the Iranians into stopping? What are their relations with Iran like?
So this is a very good question. It's one that people here in Qatar are talking about, and indeed in the other Gulf states too. They had spent the last few years developing better relations with Iran, trying to talk to them, say we're all part of the same club, we're oil exporting, why don't we all make nice? And then maybe you can also start making nice to America and even Israel as we are. The trouble is there is just this strong ideological divide at the end of the day, that the the purpose of the regime in Iran, the heart of its raison d'etre, is to stand up against Israel and to stand up against America. So all those outreach projects could only go so far while the current regime in Iran is in place, because without those two sort of building blocks, those two pillars of its ideology, of its legitimacy, the Islamic Republic is nothing, really. That's I'm speaking, through its eyes, in its own view, of course. So those are non-negotiable. And so at the end of the day, all those outreach projects, come to nothing if America decides to go to war with Iran, because the U.S. bases are in the Arab Gulf states. The economies are directed towards America. They're closely interlinked. They rely for their oil exports, as we have seen, to everyone's cost, on security in the Gulf that is guaranteed by America. They're putting in the calls to Iran, saying, what do you think you're doing? This is bad for all of us. But Iran is saying, well, it's not us that started this war. Tell the Americans to stop bombing us.
Richard, thank you very much. Richard Spencer and Dominic O'Connell with us.
We're going to talk mortgage rates and interest rates in a couple of moments' time with Dom. So, Karen, stay listening. I know you've got a query quite close to your heart. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
I thought I'd seen it all, then felt myself awaken. I thought I'd witnessed beauty before my breath was taken. I thought that I'd known wonder, then sailed beneath these skies. I thought I'd seen the world until I opened my eyes. Change the way you see the world with HX Expeditions. Search Travel HX to discover more.
You've saved carefully for your future, your plans, your peace of mind. Now there's good news. FSCS protection for your savings and current accounts has risen to £120,000 per eligible person at UK authorised banks, building societies and credit unions. From the very first pound right up to £120,000, it's all protected. So you can focus on what matters with confidence. See what it means for you at fscs.org.uk. Your savings, FSCS protected.
Listen to Times Radio at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Let Wix install your new kitchen. Choose from a wide range of kitchens and add the option of installation to your order. For complete peace of mind, all installations include a 2-year workmanship guarantee. Get started by booking a free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
So Karen's question is this, Dom. Our son is looking to put an offer on his first home and we wonder if he should.
Well, people who are shopping for mortgages right now will have already noticed that there's been a big change. So before it all started in the Gulf, a 2-year fix was about, you could get them for about 4.8%, 5-year fix, 4.9%, something like that. Now both of those are well over 5.2% and above for the 2-year and 5.3% and above for the 5-year. That's quite a sharp repricing in the space of a few weeks. And people might be thinking, well, why is this? Because interest rates haven't gone up. The Bank of England hasn't put interest rates up. It's got a decision on that tomorrow, actually, at midday tomorrow. But mortgages are priced not off the bank rate, but off indirectly gilt yields, the thing that we all got to know so much about during the Liz Truss mini budget. And there's been a big movement in the 2-year gilt yield. It started at 3.1% before the Iran conflict began. Now it's over 4%. So it's a big move for UK gilt, so which indicates what investors are thinking about inflation and interest rates and so forth. But it means that mortgages have got a lot more expensive. So I think whether you want to make an offer now or not is whether you think they might get more expensive in the future, or whether you think actually things will calm down again and gilt yields will fall, interest rate and mortgage rates might fall too.
Yes. I mean, I know that you don't want to and you shouldn't give financial advice, but it might there be an argument for not signing up to a fixed rate at the moment and to go with the variable instead?
Well, it all depends upon what happens with, because before this kicked off, the general expectation was that inflation was going to continue falling this year, perhaps even get back to the Bank of England's target of 2% late summertime, which would have been the first time it had been there in 5-6 years, more even. No, sorry, it got there briefly last year. So, and as inflation falls, interest rates will fall, mortgages should, all things being equal, get cheaper. So if normal business resumes, if all this comes to an end, to a juddering halt in the next day or two, then yeah, probably wait, it might get cheaper. But if it goes on and inflation really kicks in, and remember what happened after Russia invaded Ukraine, UK inflation went to 11% in pretty short order from almost nothing, then interest rates might well follow to bring that inflation into check. So actually it could get quite a lot more expensive in the medium term.
So it's the worst possible time to be taking out a fixed rate mortgage since the last worst possible time,
yeah. Exactly.
Okay.
Oh, thanks for being there, Dom. Fiona asks, this is for you, Richard, when Trump no doubt retreats from the war, will Israel be able to continue attacking Iran on its own? And I suppose I'd like to ask as well, Richard, let's say Trump suddenly declares victory. Will that mean that Iran will carry on attacking other Gulf states? What do you think?
So I was talking to someone on this very topic today. I think there is a growing consensus, I don't know, or the idea that Israel could carry on even if Trump stops. I think that is an idea that's gaining ground. I think the people thought originally they were in it together. But then if you look carefully, if you look at what happened last summer when Israel started bombing and Trump came in for one day, Trump did come in for one day and then say, okay, we're all going to stop, me and Israel and Iran. So I think people have read into that, that it's, you know, the similar thing will happen here, that it goes on as long as Trump wants it to. But I don't think that's true. I think it's a different situation. I think more and more people are seeing that Israel has its own goals. They're different from America's goals. They're more far-reaching. They really want to level Iran, bring it to its knees, even if there's not regime change. They have no interest in a deal that allows Iran to rebuild itself in any way at all. I think President Trump, it's always hard to tell exactly what his bottom line is, because he says one thing one day and another thing another day. But the general assumption is he is, you know, the deal's man. He wants some sort of deal. As I said earlier, America does have some vested interest in Iran emerging from this or with as a stable country in the Middle East. Israel doesn't have that incentive. And then on Iran's side, I think you're exactly right. I think Iran can say, yeah, well, you know, America stopped bombing us, but, you know, we're still angry. We're still going to hit out and make Israel and America pay for what they've done to us. And that means discontinuing to disrupt shipping. I think there's a possibility for it won't be negotiated as such, but for a, you know, one of those nudges and nods and winks types deals, if you like, where if America pulls out, Iran will focus its retaliation more directly at Israel and perhaps less at the Gulf states. I think Iran probably feels it has to hit out the Gulf states, but probably doesn't want to, if you know what I mean. So if it has an excuse to say, okay, if America stops bombing us, we'll stop bombing the Gulf states. But that doesn't mean to say it will immediately allow oil tankers to get through. It could carry on, you know, a limited campaign enough to make the West pay in general terms, while not actually attacking Gulf targets. So I think that's a scenario that people are starting to take quite seriously.
Okay, and Charlie says everybody seems to have forgotten about the people in Iran who really do want regime change. How might that happen, Richard?
Very good question. One interesting political question for Americans, I would say, just to throw a quick curveball away from that, the question is do they really believe that did Trump really believe that he could bring about regime change? That was clearly one of the ways that this war was sold, that it would end this regime once and for all, this regime that everyone dislikes, including many of his own people. Now that that doesn't seem to be on the cards, was that honest or dishonest of President Trump? Is he really surprised that that hasn't happened? He's clearly given up on the whole idea, I would judge by his recent rhetoric. Israel, however, hasn't quite given up on it. Its view is, and this is, as far as I can see, is the only realistic way that regime change could happen. Its view is if it does so much damage to Iran that chaos ensues, that every single leader, one after the other, is picked off. If they kill the new supreme leader, the son of the last supreme leader, maybe kill the one who's appointed after that. If they kill all the competent people in the regime, like Ali Larijani, the head of the National Security Council, who was killed yesterday, who was a long-term fixer and by no means was he a secular or liberal figure. He was a hardline conservative within the regime, long-term support of the regime, but he was pragmatic. He could get things going. He could organize such relations Iran has with other states. If you get rid of all these people, one after the other, and kill lots and lots and lots of the Revolutionary Guards and the besieged and the police, which Israel is doing, it's hammering away at not only at police stations and guard bases, but also at places where they're gathering elsewhere. Suggestions they're hitting the guards and the besieged started meeting in sports facilities, and then they started bombing those as well. If there is such chaos, that maybe not in, while the war's going on, it's very hard to rise up when a war's going on, but if there's such chaos and there's the security forces are so weakened that in some way some alternative force can step in and say, okay, we are now the real government, and then they can get some sort of help from outside, either physically in terms of military support or just in terms of, you know, maybe money being funneled to them to get some sort of organization together. I think that's the Israeli long-term plan, if there is one. I think you'd have to say it still doesn't look very likely, but I suppose you could argue it's possible.
It does feel a long way off, doesn't it? Richard, thank you very, very much indeed. That was Richard Spencer, who's the Times foreign correspondent. He's currently in Doha. And Dominic O'Connell, has the oil price done anything while we've been chatting?
Still hovering just around $109 a barrel.
Right. So I don't want to be too melodramatic, but are we anywhere close to petrol rationing in Britain, what would you say?
I don't think so, yeah. It's worth remembering, we talk about the oil price, the Brent crude oil price, which is a benchmark sort of on the Western Hemisphere for the Atlantic Basin. But there are other oil prices in the world. If you're trying to buy a barrel of oil in Dubai at the moment, you're paying $122 a barrel, and spot prices in Asia are a lot higher. So inventories over here are not too bad. Also, we talking there, the price of crude oil, refined products like petrol and diesel have gone up a lot more, particularly aviation fuel and shipping fuel, bunker fuel. So there's lots of different prices for these things, and not all of them, you know, we talk about the Brent crude as being it is a good benchmark index to follow, but it's not the only oil price, and it is a bit protected from what's happening in the Straits of Hormuz, but eventually it will come here.
Okay, that was relatively positive, relatively. Dominic, thank you very much.
We're slightly late to the news. Our apologies for that. It was well worth it, though. We're going to talk about Opus Dei after we get the latest headlines with Will Hobbs.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, V. Good afternoon. The University of Kent says the rollout of meningitis B vaccines for students living in halls will begin today. Around 5,000 are being offered the jab after an outbreak which has seen 20 cases identified. Two people have died. Across the country, there's been a surge in demand for vaccinations. But Olivia Pickard from the National Pharmacy Association says they're hard to get hold of.
The supply chain has come to a halt. Wholesalers don't have any stock to distribute to pharmacies, and manufacturers are currently either not releasing stock or working out how best to distribute the stock.
The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, has assured the public there's no necessity to get vaccinated and no need to buy privately. Israel claims to have killed an Iranian intelligence minister. Esmail Khatib's death, if confirmed, would follow that of Iran's powerful security chief, Ali Larijani, yesterday. Former MP Crispin Blunt's been charged with 4 drug offences. Substances including methamphetamine and cannabis were found at his home in Hawley in Surrey. And peers are considering a move to block proposals for the decriminalisation of women terminating their own pregnancies. MPs have voted in favour of the planned legislation for England and Wales, but an amendment in the Lords would remove the relevant clause. And today in the UK is the warmest of the year so far, with a temperature of 19.5 Celsius recorded in Cornwall. Temperatures widely have reached the high teens across England and Wales. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
This spring, start your own story in Scotland. Step into a land where the views are wild, the welcomes are warm, and the magic is real. From lofty mountains to vibrant cities, explore Scotland's breathtaking landscapes and uncover our ancient history. And with an exciting range of cultural events and festivals to enjoy, spring is the perfect time to plan your escape. Write your own Scottish story this spring. Start your adventure at visitscotland.com/spring.
At QuickFit, our customers drive away happy every time. Do we tell them jokes? No.
All right.
We just do our job, but don't take our word for it. Take the word of thousands of excellent customer reviews on Google and Trustpilot.
There's loads.
That's why our customers drive away happy. Quick Fit. Drive away happy every time.
Young people today, can they really handle responsibility? Or are we just kidding ourselves?
McDonald's.
Some think young people can't manage. We disagree. That's why one in three McDonald's managers are under 25.
Hey, Kira.
Hey, Belle. How are you?
You all right? Yeah, I'm good. It's busy out there, though.
Ooh. Like Kira from South London. She's 23 and manages a team of 20.
Let's go.
Leadership. Making it happen at McDonald's.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Save up to 50% on kitchen units with the Spend and Save offer. And for a limited time, there's an extra 10% off. Terms and minimum spend apply. Find your nearest kitchen showroom at wix.co.uk.
Now, I know that we didn't really bring you good cheer in the last half an hour of the programme, but that's because we're looking at world events and it's just very hard to find the sunbeams at the moment. But here's Times Radio sunbeam, John Pienaar.
Oh, Fee, that was so beautifully done.
That is a first. I'm not that I'm a sort of permanent walking rain cloud, but it's very sweet of you, Fee. So I'll just mention a couple of the things on the show. I've got the former Chief of the Defence Staff, Lord Richards, who can just give us a take on where Britain fits into this moving kaleidoscopic jigsaw of the crisis in the Middle East with Keir Starmer. Look, he's stuck, from our point of view, in the middle of all of this. He's not really in the middle of all of this. We're just looking at that because we are British after all. But you know, NATO's being shaken up. There was Donald Trump yesterday, not for the first time, but suggesting maybe we should just walk away from NATO, just chuck that in there casually. We've got the various European leaders looking at working away autonomously almost from the United States in the Middle East as well, maybe guarding the Strait of Hormuz when the fighting is over. So talking about all of that, Tony Connolly is in Brussels. He's going to be joining us. And I'm talking to a Lithuanian MP. It's suggested that some of those Balkan countries are saying, look, maybe we shouldn't get too far away from Trump. We need America here because we are exposed to Russia, and no one more than countries like Lithuania or Estonia or Poland. So I've got a Lithuanian MP on the show, and I'm looking towards Russia, where there's been an internet blackout, and the army now have turned to recruiting hardened alcoholics to go to the front line. Now, none of that is cheerful, I know, but there it is.
John, thank you.
Can we change his nickname?
We can.
Rain cloud.
Yeah.
I think so.
John Pienaar takes over from us at 4 o'clock this afternoon. It is 20 minutes to three. Now, the Pope held a meeting with a British journalist who made allegations against a powerful organisation within the Catholic Church recently. Gareth Gore is the author of Opus, about the group Opus Dei. A fictionalised portrayal of the organisation as a secretive cult appears in Dan Brown's book, The Da Vinci Code. But Mr Gore's book contains concerning claims of its own about Opus Dei, accusing it of covering up sexual crimes and abusing the faith of its members for money and influence. The organisation denies all the allegations, saying the book is littered with twisted facts, errors, conspiracy theories and even outright lies. But on Monday, Mr Gore spoke to Pope Leo for 40 minutes about those claims, and he joins us now. Mr Gore joins us now, that is, not Pope Leo, because that would be a little bit of a coup. Very good afternoon from us, Gareth. What does Opus Dei actually say that it is and its mission is?
Well, good afternoon. Thank you both for having me on the show today. So publicly, Opus Dei says that it's an official part of the Catholic Church, which it is, and that all it wants to do is help ordinary Catholics to kind of go deeper into their faith, to live out their faith in their everyday lives. But we know from leaked internal documents and from the many hundreds of hours I've spent talking to former members and survivors of this group that this is it's a high control group that abuses the legitimacy that's been placed upon it by the Vatican to collect information about its members and then use that information to manipulate them and push them into furthering its political and financial agenda.
What does that mean for individuals who join Opus Dei?
That means, so as an individual who joins Opus Dei, you're expected to, one, confess to an Opus Dei priest, And two, do these things called spiritual guidance sessions, which happens every couple of weeks. And during both confession and spiritual guidance, you're expected to basically reveal every aspect of your life. And what members do not know is that both the priest and the kind of Opus Dei Numeri, as they're called, that's been assigned to you, is the whole time collecting information and passing it up the chain. You know, there are many, many, many instances. I've spoken with previous Opus Dei priests and current Opus Dei priests who talk about habitually breaching the seal of confession to write these reports on members. And these reports are passed up the chain. You know, the Opus Dei has more in common with an organization like the Stasi than it does with any other aspect of the Catholic Church. This is an abusive organization that takes advantage of people's spirituality and their faith in order to further its own agenda.
Pope Francis reduced the power of Opus Dei, didn't he? How exactly did he do that?
So Pope Francis, in July 2022, he issued this thing called a motu proprio, which is like a papal decree. It's the, you know, the personal decision of the Pope. And he ordered this group to reform itself. And that's after a series of abuse allegations reached the Vatican, including this case in Argentina where young girls had been coerced into joining the group and basically kind of pushed into becoming these unpaid slaves for the elite members. That's since become a much bigger deal. Public prosecutors in Argentina launched a two-year investigation and are currently prosecuting Opus Dei for on charges of human trafficking and labor offenses. So he issued this decree in July 2022. And since then, Opus Dei has been working with a part of the Vatican called the Dicastery of the Clergy, which is basically the body that oversees priests, to rewrite its constitution. But as I explained in my meeting with Pope Leo on Monday, that whole process has been deeply flawed. At no point during the past 4 years has the Dicastery of the Clergy or the wider Vatican reached out to any former members or any victims of Opus Dei to fully understand how the group works. So it's important to understand that there are the official statutes, like the official face of Opus Dei, and the official statutes are signed off by the Vatican. But inside the organization, day-to-day life and this whole kind of control manipulation mechanism is dictated by hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages that were written by the founder of Opus Dei himself, this Spanish priest by the name of José María Escrivá, who, by the way, is veneered as a saint in the church today. He told his followers that he received a vision for Opus Dei directly from God and that he wrote that vision down in these hundreds of pages. And so for his followers, they believe that these writings are kind of divinely inspired, this crazy system of control, manipulation, abuse. And he went into great detail, you know, talking about how members should basically take advantage of the Opus Dei followers. They believe that this is divinely inspired, and so they don't question it.
Right. And Gareth, I mean, I know that you're not able to tell us exactly what the Pope said in his meeting with you, but you can definitely talk about the areas that you had conversations with him about. And on that area of legitimacy, what was it that you were asking Pope Leo to do? And can you tell us whether or not he was keen to hear your concerns?
He was very keen to hear my concerns. I think it's quite telling that he chose to meet me quite publicly. So I didn't know this at the time because I was asked to leave my phone in a different room before I went in to meet the Pope. But in the minutes before I shook hands with the Pope, the Vatican Press Office put out a release announcing that the Pope was about to receive me. They could have just kind of kept this off the books. They could have asked me to meet with one of his underlings. I think Pope Francis quite clearly wanted to send a signal out to Opus Dei and to the wider world that he is on top of this. This is one of his top priorities right now. At the end of the meeting, I also asked whether it would be possible to go out to the media and talk about the meeting as a signal to, you know, the victims, but also as a signal to wider society that he's listening. And he said, please do. please, he would very much welcome that. What did I ask him? I asked him actually to halt the current reform process because, as I just mentioned earlier, I believe it's been deeply flawed. I don't think the Vatican fully understands what it's grappling with. If you have a problem and you want to solve it, you must first understand what the problem is. And I think the Vatican doesn't really fully understand what it is. I also went into the meeting with a whole list of things I needed to tell him because Opus Dei's infiltration, not just of the world of politics and society, but especially at the Vatican, is very deep. And so I was unsure about how much information had actually kind of reached up to the top. And so I made it my aim going into the meeting to basically, I had a long list of things I wanted to share with him. And he listened intently and he gave me actually much more time than had been allocated in order to hear me out in full.
And do you know if he is going to act within a certain time frame and what that time frame might be?
I don't. I did suggest that a wise next step would be, in addition to halting the current reform process, would be to then launch an independent inquiry into all allegations of abuse against Opus Dei. My suggestion was that not only would that be a huge signal to the wider world that he wants to get to the bottom of this, but also it would give him potential political cover if he decided to go all the way and close this thing down. If an independent inquiry arrives, you know, at conclusions after, you know, hearing the evidence, including from Opus Dei, then, you know, that gives the Pope political cover to do whatever he thinks is necessary.
Thank you very much indeed for telling us all about that. That's Gareth Gore, and he is the author of Opus, if you want to read more about it. And just to reiterate, as we always should, that Opus Dei itself says that the book is littered with twisted facts and contains errors. You could buy it and make your own mind up.
You certainly could. We were talking earlier about the general mood of gloom, so it's just worth saying that our guest tomorrow, sorry, I've just nudged my microphone there, is Monty Don.
Oh, phew.
I know, let's just let that lie on the gloom file. Something to look forward to tomorrow.
There's a break in the clouds, isn't there?
Well, it's a beautiful day and it'll be beautiful tomorrow, I understand.
So that's 3:30, isn't it?
It's 3:30 and we're just talking about British gardens, everybody. British gardens.
So make yourself a really nice cup of tea.
Yeah.
I think get a big slice of fruitcake.
Yes.
Sit down.
Absolutely.
Enjoy.
A bit of fudge. We will talk topiary as well, so there'll be room for some cheap gags when we talk about that sort of thing. You'll have to fill in the gaps there. Right, what's next? It's telly. We're going to talk about Brenda Blethyn, who's playing Emma Hart in Channel 4's hit new version of Barbara Taylor Bradford's sweeping saga, A Woman of Substance. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Late nights on Times Radio with Times Holidays. Listen to Times Radio every night from 10 for a first take on the stories making the headlines. Plus, explore the wider news agenda with thought-provoking guests from across politics, business, the arts and more. It's your dream nightly destination for the finest mix of news, culture and conversation. Late nights on Times Radio with Times Holidays. Explore, plan and now book the perfect holiday inspired by the journalists you trust. Search Times Holidays.
The Story, the award-winning daily news podcast from The Times. Listen in the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's been over 15 minutes and your train is not here. Don't leave your money on the tracks. This is something you should hear.
Help with Delay Repay, the way to train. Trainline. Compensation is paid by the operator.
Elite athletes know performance isn't just about pushing harder, it's about smart recovery. That mindset sparked MyoMaster, founded by Lottie White and Harlequins rugby player Joe Gray, now a thriving recovery brand. As MyoMaster grew, Lottie knew their finances needed to perform at the same level as their products. That's why they chose Xero accounting software. MyoMaster uses Xero for making tax digital for VAT. They've seen how taking your finances digital strengthens a business. And from April 6th, making tax digital for income tax means many sole traders and landlords must keep digital records and submit quarterly updates. MyoMaster's advice:
Don't see MTD as just compliance. See it as a performance upgrade. Xero brings MyoMaster's sales, payroll and VAT into one place, giving Lottie confidence in her compliance and the insight to plan her next moves. With Xero, you can change the way you see MTD. Search MTD Ready.
This year at Amazon, we're increasing the electric vehicles used for deliveries across Europe to over 10,000. It's a difference you'll notice on your doorstep, where babies are made a fuss of, where we deliver footballs for kids' kickabouts, and where they deliver the football straight into next door's garden. No. Can they have their ball back, please? We're delivering change where it matters, on your doorstep. Based on projected delivery service partner vehicles across the UK and EU by end of 2026.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
And good afternoon to Natalie, who says she appreciates that we have to follow current news events, no matter how gloomy. But she is wondering if Jane Mulkerins, who is going to do the afternoon show here on Times Radio on Saturdays, isn't she, from this Saturday?
From 1 till 4.
1 till 4, don't miss it. Natalie wonders whether Jane might tackle pressing fashion issues on that show. And Natalie would like advice on what she describes as the eternal skinny jeans debate.
Natalie, I'd be interested to hear whether there are genuinely both sides of that debate. I think skinny jeans are a hellish...
Are they a no-no?
Denim thing, yep. I don't think they really suit anybody, apart from an emaciated mannequin in a shop window.
Well, I think with a bit of stretch.
No.
No,
I think they make everybody's legs look like Henry VIII's.
Oh, God. Well, that's not good. OK, and now let's talk telly. 40 years after the original, the classic Barbara Taylor Bradford novel is back on the telly, A Woman of Substance on Channel 4, doing pretty well at the moment. And this time, Brenda Blethyn stars as Emma Hart. Let's check in with TV critic Ashanti Omkar this week to talk television. Ashanti, hello, good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon. I'm good, thank you. And I'm just weighing in to say I do like skinny jeans.
Thank you. Yes.
Sorry.
I know. I think they're all right. I'm a short woman and I actually find them more forgiving than some other sorts of jeans. I will say that. I mean,
Agreed.
No jeans are particularly forgiving, but they're not bad. Right. Now, you're far too young to have seen the original Woman of Substance on the box, which I think was in the mid 80s. What do you think of this?
I really love this. My gosh, Brenda brings that role to such, you know, she's so vibrant and, you know, she's so fashionable. She really gives us that idea. It's almost like watching Succession, but with a woman, you know, helming the whole thing, which I absolutely love. And seeing a woman of this age doing what she's doing, it's just fantastic.
She's also, can we just acknowledge, got the most magnificent big hair. Yes. I mean, it doesn't look as though much could disturb it. It would take a tornado, I think, to do any damage to that head of hair. And she's right. I mean, you're right. She's 80, isn't she now, Brenda Blethyn? Hard to believe. And she really owns this.
She really does. She really does. And they've crafted this role around her. And it's really lovely to see someone like her moving from a role that she did in Vera. She, you know, I think we'd had enough of her on that. And it's great that she's moved into something new. For many of us, this is quite new. I mean, the novel itself had sold 82 million copies worldwide, but this was back in the day. Mm. So this is for a new generation. And a new generation is certainly lapping this up.
Yeah, well, I'm really glad to hear it. Actually, I was at an event last night for HarperCollins, who published Barbara Taylor Bradford, and she was a much loved writer, actually. Everybody was slightly in awe of her, but they, you know, formidable is the adjective that crops up quite a lot. But she was clearly much loved. And Catherine Jakeways, who wrote the screenplay for this version of A Woman of Substance, was there as well. And she did say that she has made this version more sort of overtly feminist. It's about a woman who unashamedly prioritises her career, which doesn't... I mean, her children have a tough time, don't they? It's not great for them.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And, you know, Catherine had worked on Apple TV's The Buccaneers as well. And that, again, gave us this look at a past world, but with a new lens. And that's exactly what they've done with this. And they've done it very well. The writing team here have done a great job with it. And I can see why it's really captured the nation. I mean, when Rivals came out on Disney Plus, it was similar. You know, people were wondering whether it would translate to this this day and age, but it really worked. And it's great to see that people are tailoring these shows to appeal to a new audience, because we're used to seeing, you know, such crystal clear picture, fantastic cinematography, all of that is there in the show.
Yeah, Yorkshire looks absolutely gorgeous, doesn't it? I think it's worth saying.
And New York.
And New York, but it's Liverpool. So that's also really good, I think. Oh, it's also got Lenny Rush and it's got Will Meller. So there's nothing not to like about this version of A Woman of Substance. Can we talk about Young Sherlock? Now, this is Guy Ritchie. I confess I don't know much about Young Sherlock. It's on Amazon Prime. Is it worth a look?
It definitely is. I can tell you that I stayed up very late and binged the whole thing because I'd had a preview, you know, preview screening at the premiere, and I'd seen only a couple of episodes, but then seeing the rest of them, because luckily Prime Video dropped all the episodes in one go. Hero Fiennes Tiffin comes together with his uncle, Joseph Fiennes, and Donald Finn plays James Moriarty, and you get to see, you know, Sherlock and Moriarty coming together as these young people, you know. Sherlock is only 19 in this, and it really takes you into a fantastic storyline that'll keep you wrapped, is what I'm going to say.
Okay. It's not violent. It's genuinely a detective show, is it?
It is a detective show. There are some violent aspects to it. There's a lot of action in this. Okay. Xing Seng plays the Princess Gulun, and you get to learn more about her and her character as you watch this. And she does a lot of the action in this, and the action is fantastic. And I can also tell you that Colin Firth is in this, and he gives us a really hammy character that will also make you smile.
Oh, good. Okay. Well, you've whetted my appetite there. Finally, quick word on Yellowstone, another part of the Yellowstone universe. This is The Madison. It's on Paramount Plus. What's it about?
This is all about a family. It's a family drama from Taylor Sheridan, who's been giving Paramount Plus hit after hit. Michelle Pfeiffer, whom we've not seen since, really, I mean, most of us saw her in the Marvel movies. She plays Stacey Clyburn. She is the matriarch of this family. Kurt Russell plays the husband. And it's got a great cast, including, you know, people like Patrick J. Adams from Suits in it. And Matthew Fox also is in this one. And it really is about how this lady, I don't want to give you a spoiler by saying this, but right at the start, you get to see a big incident happens in the first episode. And once that incident happens, everything in her life, as this woman who's doing really well for herself, she's the type of person who goes to the Met Gala with her husband. Mm-hmm. She's doing so well for herself. And then something big happens to her. And this big shock is what this story is about. How does Michelle Pfeiffer's character, Stacey, deal with it? And from the start, you can see the gravitas of the woman and the way Michelle plays her. It's fantastic.
Okay. Well, that sounds like another positive recommendation. Thank you very much for your time, Ashanti. Good to talk to you. Ashanti Omkar, who helped us out this week with a bit of a TV.
Now, Natalie, you've started something. Oh, yeah. The skinny jeans debate is now going to rage. Kate is with me. A wide leg for Kate. And Amanda says skinny jeans give you a muffin top. Well, they give me a muffin top. In fact, all jeans give me a muffin top. Well, Amanda, I'm here to say there's an awful lot wrong with the world at the moment. But high-waisted barrel leg jeans are in. They are immensely flattering for the normal-shaped woman. So what a time to be alive.
It's not all bad, is it?
It's not all bad.
No, a Monty Don tomorrow, everybody. Come on, we can do this.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
All available in a lovely dark denim too. Woof. It's 3 o'clock. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio. Still to come, Keir Starmer refused to say whether he spoke to Peter Mandelson before his appointment as ambassador to Washington. In today's PMQs, a former Labour advisor will join us in the studio. Morocco have been declared winners of the 2025 Africa Cup of Nations after the result was overturned following Senegal's walk-off. We'll be joined by our sportsman, Vassos Alexander. And after 3:30, Claire Bracey is on the programme. Claire is from the Become charity, on to discuss the work that needs to be done to tackle profiteering in the UK's children's homes. All of that after the latest news. Here's Will Hobbs.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. The University of Kent says the rollout of meningitis B vaccines for students living in halls will begin today. Around 5,000 are being offered the jab after an outbreak which has seen 20 cases identified. Two people have died. Professor Ellie Lee from the University of Kent told us her teenager is amongst them, as she knew the sixth form student who died from the infection.
My daughter was at the club with Juliet at Club Chemistry. They had a beautiful, happy, joyous evening celebrating two friends who had turned 18. And actually, on Sunday night, they all knew they needed to get antibiotics. My daughter took antibiotics at 8:30 Monday morning. So the response from the kids has been fast.
Pharmacies are running out of the meningitis B vaccine. Wes Streeting, the health secretary, reassured the public it was not necessary to get vaccinated or buy privately. Israel has claimed it has assassinated Iran's intelligence minister, Esmail Khatib. Khatib is considered the second highest ranking civilian leader after the president. Meanwhile, the funeral has been held for Iran's security chief, Ali Larijani, who was killed in an earlier Israeli airstrike. Because of the conflict, the price of Brent crude oil has risen 5% to more than $108 a barrel. Natural gas prices in the UK rose 6% to 139.4 pence per therm. At PMQs, Kemi Badenoch dedicated her questions to revelations from journalists from The Times that Keir Starmer never spoke to Peter Mandelson before his appointment as US trade envoy.
He wouldn't tell us if he actually picked up the phone and spoke to Mandelson before appointing him. This doesn't make any sense. The Prime Minister told us on the record, and I quote, "I believed the lies he told me." If the Prime Minister didn't speak to him, how can he say he lied to him?
The Prime Minister simply reiterated the appointment was his error of judgment before responding.
Now, obviously, this is a question of my judgment, but what about her judgment? She wanted to rush into a war with Iran without thinking it through. At the weekend, Mr. Speaker, three weeks in, she said, oh, there isn't a clear plan behind the US strikes in Iran. That's the question she should have asked at the start. The decision to commit the UK to a war is the biggest decision a Prime Minister can take, and she got it completely wrong.
Elsewhere, former Conservative MP Crispin Blunt has been charged with four drugs offences. The 65-year-old who once represented Reigate is accused of one count of possessing a Class A drug and three of possessing a Class B drug. And the government's preparing to sue former Chelsea owner Roman Abramovich for not releasing the £2.5 billion received from the selling of the club to support victims in Ukraine. It's believed Abramovich wants the money to go to victims of the war on both sides. The Prime Minister's spokesperson says he has failed to make the donation he committed to. And remember, the finest writers from The Times preview and review the week's football on the Game podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
That is us. It's 4 minutes past three. We're going to talk about children's homes after 3:30 this afternoon. One of our favourite writers, Anne Cleeves, came on the programme about a year ago, Jane, was it?
Yeah, a bit less than that, maybe, actually.
OK, with the publication of her latest Vera novel, which was called The Dark Wives.
Yep.
And was all about things going wrong in children's homes in the Northeast. And she had based this on real stories about profiteering in children's homes. So the notion that the people who are in charge are actually focusing on profit, they're not focusing on the lives of the kids. She described it as her only angry novel that she's written, and she was furious about it. It alerted our attention to something which has been bubbling under for such a long time, which is the dark side of privatisation, not really alleviating pressures on the public purse, definitely lining the pockets of individuals, many of whom don't even live in this country. So a lot of you wanted us to investigate this further, and that's exactly what we're going to do after 3:30. Some pretty bleak times in football as well, which you're going to talk about with Vassos.
Yeah, but on the positive side, Liverpool are going to easily overcome Galatasaray tonight.
Okay, right. So, you know. We're talking about the Africa Cup of Nations, but yeah, yes, you can do that too.
I want to shoehorn in the Champions League.
You can do that too. And we're very, very happy to have a denim rage on the programme as a bit of a distraction. If you've got any thoughts about skinny jeans, high-waisted jeans, bootcut jeans, whatever you want, I think it's a topic that audio is made for. Keir Starmer tried to turn the tables on Kemi Badenoch at PMQs. As you heard there in the news, the Conservative leader tried to push the PM on his appointment of Peter Mandelson as ambassador to Washington, but in return was attacked for her initial call for the UK to join the war against Iran.
The Prime Minister tried to avoid scrutiny on the Mandelson files by releasing the documents immediately after Prime Minister's questions last week. So let me ask him now. Did the Prime Minister personally speak to Peter Mandelson about his relationship with the convicted paedophile Jeffrey Epstein before appointing him as our ambassador to Washington?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, let me start where I must. This was my mistake in making the appointment, and I've apologised to the victims of Epstein. I do so again. The government is complying with the humble address in full, but we are also continuing to support the police in their investigation. The matter of process was looked at by the independent advisor on ministerial standards. It's clear the appointment process wasn't strong enough, and that's why I've already strengthened it. But it was my mistake, Mr. Speaker, and I've apologised for it. She should follow suit and apologise for a gross error of judgment in calling for the UK to join the war in Iran without thinking through the consequences.
Well, let's talk about all errors of judgment with Stella Chankatego, who is former Labour Party advisor. Why return to the Mandelson issue, Stella? Do you think it was the right place to go today?
I think that a lot of people will be tired of hearing about it, but it is one of the biggest indictments on Keir Starmer's judgment. There were obviously the updated book by Maguire and Pogrom that was the updated chapters that were published in the Sunday Times over the week, and which highlighted how Keir Starmer doesn't have an opinion of his own and how Keir Starmer doesn't take decisions by his own instinct and using his own judgment. And perhaps this was the consideration that Kemi Badenoch did and decided to go back to this topic. And she tried to make to ask him twice about it. He asked him once, and then he asked him a second time, says clearly taken the feedback about the fact that you need to pick one issue and zero in. But then that was a bit forgotten because of what is actually happening in the world and what will be the concern of a lot of people, specifically what is happening with Iran and what's going to happen with the oil crisis. And at the same time, it did look a bit bad when you had basically both of the prime minister and the leader of the opposition doing personal attacks at each other, talking about their judgment and their leadership values rather than trying to discuss any specific policy issues. So it felt a bit confused.
And it is difficult, isn't it? Because if what they're trying to do was join two themes with you've made a very bad error of judgment, you know, the themes are just so very, very different, aren't they? And you're right. I mean, Kemi Badenoch did keep coming back. The point that she was trying to make was to catch Keir Starmer out over whether he'd actually physically had the conversation with Peter Mandelson. Now, it felt like she had all of the ammunition. Do you think that actually it did hit the target?
I think Andrew Snowden later hit the target eventually. And Kemi Badenoch will be very pleased with the fact that her own MPs turned back to it. And she seemed quite confident about it as well. But at the same time, it did highlight her own U-turn and her own lack of judgment. So in the end, it did feel like you had two leaders who were trying to prove to their own backbenches that they are the ones who have the most confidence in their leadership qualities. And I'm not sure that came across.
Yeah. I tell you what, I'm just going to alert Ryan to this fact. We're going to go to, I think, what's probably the final clip in the running order here, because we can hear exactly the question that you're referring to, which was asked by a fairly furious Tory MP, Andrew Snowden. Let's hear this.
Every week the Prime Minister comes here and reads out this pre-scripted nonsense that bears no resemblance to the questions he's actually asked. The Leader of the Opposition asked him about Peter Mandelson and he answered about the war in Iran. The Leader of the Opposition asked him about Mandelson again and he answered with an attack on the Shadow Justice Secretary. He was asked about Mandelson again and talked about protests in London. What is he scared of? What is he hiding? For a man who has spent years presenting himself as a forensic investigator, he has certainly had a blind spot to the details.
Well, let's go back and hear what made him so very furious. So this was Kemi Badenoch's third question.
He has repeatedly told us that Peter Mandelson lied to him, but he won't tell us if he actually picked up the phone and spoke to Mandelson before appointing him. This doesn't make any sense. The Prime Minister told us on the record, and I quote, "I believed the lies he told me." If the Prime Minister didn't speak to him, how can he say he lied to him?
Yeah. Prime Minister. Mr. Speaker, the process is clear. It's been looked at by the independent advisor. And she asked me about the process and judgment on appointments. She appointed the Shadow Justice Secretary. He said last night that Muslims praying in public, including the Mayor of London, practicing his faith, are not welcome. He described it as an act of domination, straight from the Islamist playbook. If we're in my team, it'd be gone. It's utterly appalling. She should denounce his comments and she should sack him.
Well, that's referring to a post by Nick Timothy, the Shadow Justice Secretary, and we'll talk about that in a moment, Stella. But, I mean, you know, we hear the cheers and the jeers that go up at the mention of the process, and that's the problem, isn't it? I mean, it just, your heart sinks a little bit, I think, as a viewer or listener when you think that a process is going to be what everything depends upon.
I think that Keir Starmer has suffered all of the damage that he's going to suffer from about the Peter Mandelson scandal. I'm not sure there is that much to add. I do not think that there are any people there who are thinking, poor Keir Starmer, he really tried with Peter Mandelson. He really tried to make the right choice. He had no options. I don't think anybody is thinking about that at all right now. So I'm not sure whether there is any extra benefit to be had from going back to this discussion. I think it makes sense that they would bring it up this week, given what happened last week. But I'm just not sure that this is exactly where they will be able to damage his reputation further, because I think it's already quite damaged.
Yeah. What do you make of the post by Nick Timothy, the Shadow Justice Secretary? Now, he posted a video of Muslims praying in Trafalgar Square. He put that up on X, and he wanted to try and make the point that he believed that in a public place, this mass prayer is a declaration of domination. Do you think this is going to turn into something quite serious for Kemi Badenoch?
I don't think she will deal with this in the way we would expect her to deal with this 5 years ago. And I think this post shows how much the Overton window really has moved, because it is true. 5 years ago, this would be a fireable offence for a Conservative shadow minister. And Dominic Grieve, the former Attorney General and Home Secretary, commented on that post as well and said this is actually unacceptable to hear from a Conservative frontbencher, because if you are saying this about Muslim people praying in Trafalgar Square, do you say the same when we have other religious events in the same place in public? To which Nick Timothy responded that the difference is that the specific type of prayer that was taking place, there is the specific purpose of that is to show a physical domination, let's say, over the space. But it is a really difficult conversation, and it is shocking that we have reached the stage where it is being discussed in the way that it is. And it was, even though it seemed out of place for Keir Starmer to bring it up, it would have been a massive missed opportunity for him to bring it up, because it will make a lot of people in the Conservative Party feel very uncomfortable.
Yeah. Why would it have been wrong for Keir Starmer to bring it up?
Because he wasn't... I do not think that it was specifically wrong that he brought it up. I think that he brought it up during a time when he was asked something, and rather than answering the question,
okay. Right, I'm with you.
He was saying, and what about this thing that you didn't do?
Yeah. The Tory leader touched on another rather difficult subject for Keir Starmer, some recent comments by Angela Rayner.
The Prime Minister wants to talk about my leadership. I'm shocked because his former deputy has just fired the starting gun on the race to replace him. And I'll tell him one thing. She and I both agree that this weak man should be replaced by a strong woman.
Right. Really is bish bash bosh this week, isn't it? That's after Angela Rayner criticised the government's plans to reform indefinite leave to remain. So the race to succeed Keir Starmer heats up again.
It was already heated up again, but the difference is, and I watched that speech. I was in the room yesterday when Angela Rayner was giving that speech. Everybody already knows that there are loads of frontbench MPs who are preparing their leadership campaigns, or they are preparing for a new cabinet, and they want to show that they are serious contenders. But the speech, what I found very interesting about it is the fact that it focused a lot on immigration, which you would expect to be an issue. It is obviously important, and we know that a lot of people from a lot of Labour members who would be voting on a Labour leadership election are very disgruntled about. But I was surprised to see this being one of the main points of contention with the Keir Starmer leadership. And she said, Time is running out for us to convince people that the Labour Party can make a difference from their lives. And if the Labour Party cannot prove that they can make a difference for people's lives, then reform will take that position and we cannot let that happen.
But that is being said by people across the front bench, isn't it? Shabana Mahmood has said we cannot do the things that we want to do in this country unless we have a radically different approach to immigration. It's not just Angela Rayner who can bring that to the forefront.
Yeah, although Shabana Mahmood takes the completely different view of what that difference entails. And what Angela Rayner was trying to put across with her speech is that there is a way to be sensible and to listen to people's concerns about all sorts of issues which do not betray Labour values. And specifically the way that the party speaks about immigration, about the refugee crisis, these are things that are very close to a lot of Labour members' principles.
Yeah. We did actually hear from Nigel Farage at this PMQ session. Let's have a listen.
Over the course of the last year, our North Sea neighbours, Norway, have opened 49 drill sites for gas and oil. On our side of the North Sea, the number is zero. Given that our critical reserve of natural gas is down to 2 days and how vulnerable we are, and with talk potentially of energy rationing coming later this year, isn't it time we change course, got rid of excessive taxation on the exploration companies, opened up the licences, became self-sufficient in natural gas, and with that would come thousands of jobs, increased tax revenues and cheaper gas prices? Isn't it time we followed Norway?
Mr. Speaker, oil and gas will be part of the mix of our energy for many, many years to come, as I've set out many, many times. But he's now highlighting the consequences of the war that he said we should rush into.
Do you think that was the best use of Nigel Farage's question?
No, precisely because of the answer that Keir Starmer gave him. It's quite strange that he would fall into that trap, and it shows his lack of experience with parliamentary debates, because he should know that the main reason why the prices are going up right now is because of what's happening in Iran. And he should also know that even if the Labour government did do what he's asking for, that does not mean that the price of gas would change, because that is being dictated by European markets. He's, however, absolutely right. There would be more high-paying jobs in the North Sea, and that would be a good thing. And there are unions who support not banning fracking without a plan, Unite and GMB. But at the same time, it did highlight the fact that he did a U-turn on a position where his party is very, very far away from what most people in the UK believe. Mm.
Stella, always nice to see you. I really mangled your surname at the beginning when I introduced you. No, don't be nice to me about it. I'm going to have another go. Give me marks out of 10, OK? Stella Chantakedu.
Oh, better? Much better. I would say 7 out of 10.
Yes, OK. Well, I'm really sorry. I apologise. It's a beautiful name and it's lovely to see you. Thank you very much indeed for your time this afternoon.
Vassos Alexander is next when we're talking about sport. Is it possible to walk off the pitch and still walk away with a cup? Apparently not, if you're Senegal. It's Joan and Fee on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
The State of It USA is the new podcast from The Times and The Sunday Times that brings you real truth about US politics and power. Join political heavyweights Katie Balls and Gerard Baker as they take a deep dive into the latest wrangles in the White House and bring you intelligent analysis and insight. No fake news, no flag waving, and no Trump derangement syndrome.
Fascinating week in Trumpland, MAGA-land, what used to be called the United States of America.
Just the inside track on the decisions that are shaping America. The State of It USA is available now on the Times Radio app or from your preferred podcast provider.
You've saved carefully for your future, your plans, your peace of mind. Now there's good news. FSCS protection for your savings and current accounts has risen to £120,000 per eligible person at UK authorised banks, building societies and credit unions. From the very first pound right up to £120,000, it's all protected. So you can focus on what matters with confidence. See what it means for you at fscs.org.uk. Your savings, FSCS protected.
Stop it.
At QuickFit, our customers drive away happy every time.
Get up.
Do we tickle their feet? No.
Oh, all right.
We just do our job, like having an excellent range of tyres to suit every car on the road.
Oh, that's good to know.
That's why our customers drive away happy. QuickFit. Drive away happy every time.
I thought that I'd seen beauty. Then I sailed where icebergs gleam. I thought I'd witnessed nature, but this surpassed my dream. I thought that I'd known wonder, then sailed beneath these skies. I thought I'd seen the world until I opened my eyes. Change the way you see the world with HX Expeditions. Search Travel HX to discover more.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens, helping create kitchens to feel proud of. From expert design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan, through to a professional installation service. Learn more at wix.co.uk.
Sport. Senegal are going to fight that decision to strip them of their Africa Cup of Nations title, which was handed last night, I have to say, rather dramatically, to Morocco. The ruling came as punishment for Senegal's players just walking off the pitch during the final in January. Here is Vassos Alexander to remind us of all this. It was a stormy old encounter, that final, wasn't it?
It was absolutely extraordinary. So, I mean, if you don't... This is nearly 2 months ago now. So Senegal playing in the final of the Africa Cup of Nations in Morocco. Even before the match, they were cross about, you know, their security arrangements weren't okay, their hotel wasn't brilliant, they had to train by Morocco's base, all of this. So there was sort of simmering discontent in the Senegalese camp anyway. Mm-hmm. Then during the 90 minutes, it was 0-0. They felt a lot of refereeing decisions went against them. I think most neutrals felt that a lot of refereeing decisions went against them. And then right at the end, they scored what looked like a perfectly good goal, which was disallowed by the referee. He had blown the whistle before play had finished, so VAR couldn't intervene. And then they went down the other end, Morocco, and were awarded a very soft penalty. So Senegal were absolutely, this lab was the last straw.
Fuming.
And they were absolutely fuming. The players, the coaching staff, everyone just basically walked off the field. Apart from Sadio Mane, who Liverpool fans will remember. He sort of stayed and 17 full minutes later, he persuaded his teammates to come back on the pitch and continue the match. That penalty actually was saved. It was a very weak, one of those little dinked Panenka penalties.
Always a risk.
So, yes, at that moment as well, to do that.
Just welly it.
Yes, exactly. Just because then it looks much better if you miss. But if you try and dink it and then you miss and the goalkeeper just stays there and catches it, it's like, oh, what have I done? Mm. And then Senegal went on to win the game, which everyone thought the right thing has happened because they were, you know, so many decisions went against them in extra time, 1-0. And so then they celebrated, and then 2 months went by. And then yesterday, the appeal board, which is made up of 9 people from various African nations, not Senegal and not Morocco, actually, currently, they met to have a chat about it and to consider an appeal from Morocco. And then they agreed that Senegal, by walking off the pitch, had contravened Articles 82 and 84 of the whatever it is that the African Cup of Nations is, you know, is played under. Article 82 states that if a team, quotes, leaves the ground before the regular end of the match without the authorisation of the referee, they are eliminated.
Why is it taking so long, though?
I know. I mean, even some VAR decisions have come, you know, quicker than this. Yeah.
It's crazy.
I know. It really, it does just beggars belief. And the thing is, you know, well, so obviously Senegal, the government have now got involved this afternoon. The FA have said they're going to appeal. The government say they want an independent international investigation into suspected corruption at the African Federation, the governing body, because of, you know, because of all of this. I mean, it's a big old row. It was a controversial match. The controversy rumbles on now. Of course Senegal are going to appeal. It'll end up at the Court of Arbitration for Sport. Do you know what? I was thinking today, thank goodness that everyone just agrees that the Court of Arbitration for Sport have the final say on all sporting disputes, because, you know, at least we will get somewhere and there will be an answer and CAS will rule on this.
And everyone accepts their rulings, do they?
Yeah.
Okay.
So right. It's a sort of, it's just a widely accepted, if it's a sporting thing, and it'll be written into constitutions.
Right.
If you appeal and appeal and appeal, it just eventually it gets to CAS and they can act quite quickly if they want to. And then they're decision is binding and final.
Okay, let's go to Chelsea. The government says it's going to sue Roman Abramovich, former owner of the West London outfit, over the cash from the sale of the club. Now, what happened here?
So, when Russia invaded Ukraine, some prominent Russians, including Roman Abramovich, were sanctioned. It was Liz Truss, who was the foreign secretary at the time. She announced an asset freeze and travel ban on 7 of Russia's most wealthy and influential oligarchs, who she suggested were close to the Kremlin. And no one seemed to sort of dispute that. And Roman Abramovich was told, basically, you have to sell Chelsea. And if you do, we'll freeze those assets and we'll agree that you'll give them to a good cause. And that seemed to be sort of happening. Mm-hmm. He did sell Chelsea and the assets were frozen and they've been in a, I don't know where, a bank account somewhere or wherever frozen assets go. And then there was a deadline of yesterday for him to keep a promise and basically... So the government said, why don't we do this? And just Roman Abramovich had to say yes. And that deadline passed and he didn't say yes yesterday, right, which was the deadline. And so now the government is saying, right, we're going to have to take you to court.
So this has been another long-running saga and a thoroughly messy and unpleasant business, hasn't it, really?
I mean, it really has. And, you know, there are £2 and a bit billion that could do a lot of good. I mean, everyone agrees that why don't we give them to victims of the war? I think the British government is saying give it to Ukrainian victims and Roman Abramovich is saying giving it to all victims.
OK, so, we'll keep an eye on that, although it could be years before that is finally sorted out.
Right. Well, I mean, yeah, there's no Court of Arbitration for Sport on this one. I think it's the normal courts.
Right, and a sporting victory by Venezuela over the US. Now, they'll have enjoyed this, won't they?
Yes, Venezuela has beaten Team USA to claim the World Baseball Classic for the first time in a thrilling final. It's just funny how, you know, politics and sport happens, and it had to be Venezuela and the USA in the final. It was in Miami, and it was 3-2 to Venezuela against a star-studded US team who'd hoped to emerge triumphant after losing the final in 2023. I can't quite believe that the USA, who have the Baseball World Series, which is only involving US teams, when it gets to an the first hint of an international baseball tournament, and they can't win it. Venezuela, of all teams, have beaten the USA.
Well, there's something strangely satisfying about it.
Isn't there just? Yeah,
there kind of is. Now, there is Champions League action tonight. Manchester City didn't progress. They haven't. What's the furthest they've ever got in the Champions League?
Oh, they've won it.
Oh, have they? I don't remember that kind of thing.
No.
Have they really?
Yeah.
Really?
I know.
Little Manchester City.
Little Manchester City.
Oh. You are funny because I think you dismiss Manchester United.
Oh, I don't. I don't follow Manchester of any kind.
What you really are. It's like a complete and utter
curtain drawn.
Yep. It just doesn't figure.
So they lost 5-1 to Real Madrid last night. Chelsea lost 8-2 to Paris Saint-Germain. Arsenal are through. They beat Leverkusen 3-1 on aggregate. So Liverpool and Newcastle and Tottenham are in action tonight. Liverpool, I think they'll probably get through. They're trailing 1-0 against Galatasaray.
To be honest, I don't think I am all that confident. I'm not sure. I mean, he's got old Slot's having a tough time, isn't he?
I know. And that was a bad old result against Tottenham. They were 1-0 up against Tottenham, who couldn't buy a win from anywhere. And then suddenly to concede a last-minute equaliser. So I think Liverpool fans would have been confident until last weekend. But it was a pretty poor performance last weekend. And some of the big players just aren't playing well for Liverpool. Mm. But you would back them to win tonight. And Barcelona and Newcastle could be an absolute belter. Newcastle outplayed them at St James's Park last week. And they will fancy their chances going in the biggest match in Newcastle's history, bar none. And Tottenham, we discussed it, didn't we, last week when they had an absolute shocker against Atletico Madrid, 5-2 down ahead of the second leg.
Well, stranger things have happened.
Yeah, well, I know Spursier things have happened, to be honest.
That's true. Thank you, Vassos. Vassos is with us every day at this time. And if you want more any of the stories we've talked about, you can go to thetimes.com and head straight to the sports section.
Coming up, should people be allowed to turn children's care homes into profit? Let's get a check on the latest news headlines. It's just gone 3:30. Here's Will Hobbs.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Fee. The University of Kent says the rollout of meningitis B vaccines for students living in halls will begin today. Around 5,000 are being offered the jab after an outbreak which has seen 20 cases identified. Over 2,500 doses of antibiotics have been given to students and close contacts. The Prime Minister has issued this appeal in the Commons.
Can I take this opportunity to ask anyone who attended Club Chemistry on March 5th, 6th or 7th to come forward, please, to receive antibiotics.
Israel's claim to have killed an Iranian intelligence minister, Esmail Khatib's death, if confirmed, would follow that of Iran's powerful security chief, Ali Larijani, yesterday. Former MP Crispin Blunt's been charged with 4 drugs offences. Substances including methamphetamine and cannabis were found at his home in Hawley in Surrey. Downing Street refused to back the Home Secretary's controversial immigration reforms after they were labelled un-British by Angela Rayner. Number 10 repeatedly refused to say that the changes, which would up the time it takes for migrants to qualify for permanent residence, would go ahead on Wednesday as planned. And the Senegalese government has called for an independent international investigation into suspected corruption at African football's governing body. It's after it stripped Senegal of the 2025 Africa Cup of Nations title and overturned their win over Morocco 2 months ago because of the players' decision to walk off the field for a penalty that was given against them. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
The UK government is backing businesses with support to grow overseas. Darren Litton is the founder of Kokoba, a company that's grown from a humble pop-up kiosk to a luxury chocolate brand that's now exporting to Europe, North America and Australia.
Hi, I'm Darren Litton. UK Export Finance has been a fantastic resource for us and a great help. They're at the end of the phone with any questions we have and also being able to guarantee our trade finance facility, which we've also been fantastic. The support we've had from UK Export Finance has enabled us to get our trade finance loan, which means that we've not had to say no to an order overseas and helped us to expand into a lot of different markets, including the US, Canada, Australia, Japan, Netherlands, and many other countries that we're currently speaking to and launching into. It's helped us to manage risk by if there's ever any problems with being able to get insurance on a customer overseas, they're there and able to provide assistance in most of the cases.
To find out more about how your business could benefit from UK Export Finance support, visit ukexportfinance.gov.uk.
Daryl Morris wraps up the weekend's news and takes a look at the week ahead, Saturday and Sunday from 10 p.m.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens. Choose from over 80 kitchen styles. Whether it's your first home or your forever home, find your dream kitchen at Wix. Prices start from under £3,000. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
We are very open to bringing you guests on subjects that you want to hear more about on this programme, and our next two guests are here by popular demand because whenever we've grazed across the subject of children in care, quite a few of you get in touch asking for us to dig a bit deeper into what's happened with children's homes in particular in this country over the last decade or so. We also heard about this from our guest Anne Cleves last year when she came on to talk about her latest Vera book called The Dark Wives, which has a theme of kids in care, something very close to Anne's heart as a former social worker. She was outraged at the notion that these homes have become profit opportunities for wealth funds and investors, and she very much believes that that's at a cost to the kids who are in them. The cost is clearly revealed by a report by Centre for Thriving Places as part of a programme called Reclaiming Our Regional Economies. Now, the report reveals that private companies operating care services in just three regions in the UK have extracted over £250 million in profit in just 3 years. Now, these are care homes, not just children's homes, but the report is clear about how the funding of these services in North East, South Yorkshire and West Midlands combined authority regions has been hugely beneficial to investors. £45 million was paid out in dividends to shareholders alone. Rosie McGuire is the co-author of the report.
So I think just in those 3 years, in those three regions, there was £250 million in profit. That in of itself, in the conversations we're having today, feels like an important starting point. But I think once you start to drill down in that, there was £88 million that was taken out by organisations that either were private equity firms or were based in tax havens or some combination of the two. And that's money that really, you know, that's not coming back into those local economies because it's been taken out by organisations that are either not in this country or, you know, the way in which they're structured, they put in an investment because they want to take money out. It's not going back into the care system.
Why aren't there any systems in place, Rosie, that mean you cannot, as a private investor, take that amount of money out of public services? Is there literally nothing within the process of privatisation that can guard against that?
Well, I think the process of privatisation starts with first turning what are these relational public service into a product, into a thing that's commoditised. So I think we have to start with that. What have we then defined can be bought and sold? So I think there's something there as a national conversation we need to have about what is care? What is these things that we should be providing for young people? In terms of like what is possible within current legislation, there's actually things that local authorities can do. And I'm not sure that they all understand, you know, the limits and the potential of what's possible in procurement legislation. They can work with the local market to kind of support and encourage different types of local organisations, ones that are less profit extracting or extracting in other ways. And there's some really exciting things coming up at the moment about regional care co-ops, which is about supporting local authorities to band together and think about what it is they can do to commission within their local market and encourage other forms of business. We don't necessarily have anything at the moment about limitations like pure hard lines. There's a conversation happening in Wales at the moment. There's new legislation coming in there where they have prohibited from this year extraction of profit in children's care, but we don't yet have that in England. The underlying structure of what we're talking about is care as a commodity. And I think we have to start with a conversation there about what we can do to reduce that. And then what can we do around procurement, what we can do about supporting local care ecosystems to kind of design that out.
What do you believe that lack of reinvestment has actually meant to the care systems, and in particular, those three regions that you've looked at here?
So I think if we look at children's homes in particular, I mean, one thing there is about property and buildings. If money's taken out, it's not being put into either maintaining or supporting. And this is where, you know, a lot of money can be extracted in buildings and making sure that the future children's homes remain. I think another side of that is in staffing. I mean, one of the things that we talk about in extraction is not just the cash, the money that's taken out, but also the extraction from the workforce, from the people that care for our children. You know, that is a vocation and it's an act of love. And that's often underpaid and undervalued, whilst at the same time, a lot of those in some of these more extractive practices have directors that are taking that money out. So there's a real inequality there, even within organisations and institutions. And just going back to that local economy point, if we're not looking after local workers with this money that we're putting into the system, then it does also have a knock-on effect on what they're able to do, how they're able to look after their families.
I know that in your report, in fact, you identified that directors of some of these companies were earning up to 60 times more than the average wage, while frontline care workers were often paid below the living wage. I mean, again, I suppose it's the same question. Why isn't there something in place that might prevent that quite unbelievable disparity?
I mean, I don't think I have an answer. I think that's a question that probably ourselves, yourselves, and all the listeners today can and should be asking of our MPs. When we're, you know, we're talking about things that are public services, are public goods. What is it that we should be doing collectively as a society to say what is and is not possible? And I don't know if you saw in the report, there's, you know, the top 15 children's care homes are making 23% profit. But there's obviously a lot going on here. So there is a societal question. There is a question to those who have the power to make some of these decisions.
Privatisation obviously is meant to alleviate the burden on the public purse. I mean, does it at least do that?
It doesn't look like it, given that all we're hearing all the time is the care system is at breaking point. I think Baroness Casey quoted last week that was about adult social care. But we know that lots of local authorities are also facing significant financial challenges within that element of care, whether it's children's care or whether it's the SEND system, which is another part of this conversation. You know, public sector in general is really struggling. And I think even if you just look at those figures, that is a snapshot. The fact that that money is able to be taken out, there's something obviously not quite working here. If on one hand we've got public sector stretched to the limits, and yet on the other hand that amount of money is able to be taken out, and yet people in general don't necessarily feel that the system is working to the best of its ability.
That is Rosie Maguire from Centre for Thriving Places. Well, let's pick up all of that with Claire Bracey, who's Director of Policy Campaigns and Communication for Become. Hello, Claire.
Good afternoon.
Hi. Can you just tell us a little bit about what Become does?
Yeah, so Become is a national charity supporting children in care and young care leavers. And we do that in a variety of ways. We provide services to young people to help them make sure they know what their rights and entitlements are, but also to help them thrive, to help them develop in their lives in different ways. So lots of services. We train professionals too, so that professionals can give better support to young people. And we campaign for changes to the care system. We work alongside young people and we campaign alongside care experience young people. So we listen to what they're telling us and then we campaign together to make those changes that they're telling us are desperately needed.
Okay. Given all of that experience, Claire, let me ask you the big question. If we spooled back time to when privatisation of care services was first introduced, do you believe that there should have been a better outcome than the one that we have now?
Absolutely. I mean, I think when we're hearing about profit and markets and private equity, it's really easy to forget that what we're talking about here are children's homes where children are growing up. And it's children that are paying the price for the situation that we are in now. We shouldn't be in the situation that we are in today. That is not having a good impact for children. In fact, it's having a devastating impact for them and their lives.
But privatisation shouldn't necessarily be bad. I mean, it should relieve the taxpayer of a burden. It can enable a more nimble way of operating. Mm-hmm. So what's happened here?
Yeah, and I should say, we don't believe that all private provision is bad. There are some private providers who are doing excellent work, particularly supporting children with more complex needs. But yes, it is a more complex picture. I think if we look back, in terms of how we got to where we are today, it's a variety of things. First of all, we've had more children coming into care, particularly, over the last decade. So we've had a big increase in children coming into the care system. Money that was spent on early intervention to try and prevent that, things like sure start centres, for example, that money stopped. And instead, we were spending money at the emergency end of the system instead. And then a number of local authority run children's homes reduced over the years, partly due to cost, but also a result of maybe not wanting to carry risks that were associated with abuse scandals that we saw in children's homes too. So that combination of factors has enabled private providers to step into that space, really. And I think that's partly why we are where we are today.
Why are more children coming into the care system, Claire?
Well, I think there's a variety of reasons. I mean, we definitely have seen an increase in poverty, and that might play a part. We also, actually, when you look at the data, children are coming in who are older. So we've got more teenagers coming into care. So actually, the demographics of children coming in and needing care has changed quite a lot over the years, too. And there'll be a variety of reasons, because every child is different and every case is different. But we're certainly seeing older teenagers coming into care. And maybe, you know, it's a system that wasn't set up to begin with for older teenagers.
I know one of the things that you are very keen to highlight at Become are the distances that some children and young people are having to go in order to get a place in a children's home. And I think it's true, isn't it, that children in private children's homes are 2.5 times more likely to be living far away. Now, by far away, you mean more than 20 miles from home, which must have obvious problems and consequences.
Yeah, it has a devastating impact. And, you know, partly this is the result of children's homes being built in places where it's cheaper, where property is cheaper. What that means is children then are having to be moved across the country. So 18,000 children in care right now are living more than 20 miles away. That's 1 in 5. And the impact for them is completely devastating. So if you think about having to move far away, it impacts your education. So, you know, you're going to maybe have to move schools, or if not, you're going to have a very long journey to get to school. It's definitely going to impact on your friendships, not being able to stay connected to your friends, to people you care about, to your siblings, your brothers and sisters, for example. It can make you feel very lonely and isolated. And I think a key one as well is, you know, a greater risk of exploitation, because if you're moved far away, you're probably not going to have the people who know you, who are looking out for you and recognising the signs, perhaps, that you are at risk of exploitation. So lots of different impacts for young people. And, you know, that's just as a result, really, of investors driving where homes are instead of where children actually need them to be.
The amount of money local authorities have spent on private children's homes has increased a lot, hasn't it? 3.5 times in the year 2023 to 2024. Why so much?
Well, I think if you think about the numbers, private providers, 84% of children's homes are run by private providers. That's a 60% increase over the last 5 years. So, you know, they have dominance over the sector. Councils are forced to compete, and providers can decide which children to home. So it's a really challenging situation for local authorities, because they don't run the homes. They don't have the ability to direct where those homes need to be. And private providers can charge what they want to provide.
Sometimes stories make it into the papers and onto radio and television that just seem mind-boggling. It's not unusual for fees to exceed £8,000 a week for a child with complex needs. I wonder, Claire, whether you can put that into context for us. I mean, is that just, quite a kind of eye-catching headline? What's the reality around that figure?
Yeah, so it's going to vary. And I think what I would say is there are some children who do have really complex needs where those costs are going to be high. But ultimately, you know, nationally, across the picture, we are seeing, you know, a huge amount of money that is being paid out. And that's money that should be supporting children who have been through, you know, unimaginable trauma, supporting them to heal, to thrive. And instead, you know, that money in some cases is going into the pockets of shareholders. You know, that's not acceptable.
Do you think, as Rosie so clearly outlined, that the huge problem around this is it's quite a hidden world, isn't it? It is probably quite easy for most people to look the other way, for most people not to know somebody who has grown up in care, and for most people not to realise the devastating consequences that can accompany that.
Yeah, and I think that's right, because if you think about adult social care, you know, most of us will have family at one point who are going to need adult social care. But with children's social care, it is more hidden. So I think there is a lack of understanding. There's probably some stigma there too, in terms of misunderstanding why children go into care. So that has an impact too. But we definitely need to have a strong focus on this issue, because it's not acceptable for the young people who are in care right now to be experiencing that instability, those moves. It's having a really devastating impact for them and their outcomes.
Is change afoot under this government?
Well, I think that has been really positive, actually. If you think, this is not a situation that has appeared overnight. This has been an issue that has been there for many, many years. And I think the government, you know, recognised the scale of the issue, and they have been taking action. So, for example, we've got the Children's Wellbeing and Schools Bill going through Parliament at the moment. That introduces, you know, a number of really welcome measures, including better financial oversight and the powers to bring in a profit cap, for example, and as well as, you know, some other important developments within that bill. They've also recently announced a National Fostering Action Plan, which again is a really welcome step. But what it doesn't do is show the full picture. You know, children won't always, a foster home won't always be appropriate for children in care. You know, we will always need to have residential care too. So it's really important that we understand that full picture. What we want to see, what we think is missing from what the government are doing at the moment, is a national sufficiency strategy. We really need accountability at the top. And that means that they need to provide a plan for how they are going to manage this over the coming years, not just fostering, but children's residential care as well, because children in care are counting on it.
How many children are in care across the UK at the moment, Claire?
We've got over 80,000 children in care right now. And as I said earlier, 18,000 children, one in five of them, are living far away from their local areas.
So how can people do something about this if they're listening and thinking, yeah, I've got a view, I want to express it, I'd like to see some change?
Well, I think absolutely get in touch with your MPs. And it's really important, particularly for young people, that their voices can be represented in Parliament too. So the more people we have telling MPs about the issues, saying that they care about the issues, means we can keep up that political pressure and make sure that changes happen for children.
Claire, you said that local councils wanted to move away from providing their own care, their own children's homes, because they were worried about the risk of, for example, abuse scandals. But presumably abuse scandals are no less likely in a private setting. What would you say about that?
Yeah, and I think that's true. If you look at sort of, you know, Ofsted reports as well, not just abuse scandals, but in terms of the quality of care, you know, it's mixed across the country. There's different inspection reports that you can read. And for some young people, you know, they're having a great experience. For others, they are living in, you know, really not good enough homes. Mm. So it doesn't really matter whether it's private or local. We need to make sure that the children are living in really good quality homes.
Yeah, I mean, is it Ofsted who go in, or is it the CQC, or is it both?
Well, Ofsted are responsible for inspecting children's homes, and those reports are publicly available as well.
Right. You see, most of us, as Fee was saying earlier, this is a world that's, because we've been very fortunate, so alien to us that we just don't know anything about it. I mean, I suppose it's also true that we might very well be benefiting because we won't know what our pension's invested in. I mean, is there anything we can do about that?
I mean, that's a really good question, and one I just wouldn't have an answer to, I'm afraid.
But it is true, isn't it, that quite a lot of this money, this extraction, as it's called, it does end up abroad, doesn't it? It's quite often maybe a sovereign wealth fund that might be interested in our care homes, hedge funds, places that, you know, aren't just outside Reading or Birmingham.
Mm. I think it's really important that we eliminate profiteering from children's social care. You know, we said earlier, private provision, there's some great private provision happening, but profiteering is something that we really need to eliminate. In the Children's Wellbeing Bill, there are powers to bring in profit caps for private providers, but it's really unclear at the moment, actually, how that would work in practice. And so, you know, we need to understand a bit more about what the government plans to do there to tackle that.
Well, we would certainly like to keep in touch with you on that front, Claire, and thank you very much indeed for talking to us this afternoon. Claire Bracey is Director of Policy Campaigns and Communication for Become. Now, we were hoping as well to talk to a children's minister today, but unfortunately times are a little bit busy. A spokesperson for the Department for Education, though, has given us a statement. I'll just read it out. Vulnerable children across the country have long been let down by years of drift and neglect in children's social care. But this government is gripping the issue and taking swift action to fix the broken care system. Through the Children's Wellbeing and Schools Bill, we're introducing tough new laws to tackle profiteering in children's homes and will not hesitate to take further action to cap provider profits if unacceptable profiteering continues. We want all children in care to be in loving homes where they get the support they need, which is why we're investing £2.4 billion in the Families First Partnership Programme to stop children entering care by keeping families together, and have laid out ambitious plans to boost the number of foster homes available in England.
And just a quick mention of Scotland, because Kirsty has WhatsApp to say, non-profit in care, Scotland are also looking to reduce and remove profit in private fostering and residential care via the Children Care, Care Experience and Services Planning Bill. It's going through the Scottish Parliament just now, in fact, and stage three will be voted on today, or they are at stage three of the vote today. So that's Kirsty, and thank you for that. So clearly efforts going on elsewhere to try and do something about this. Where are we? We're at Times Radio. What time is it?
I think it's about 5 to 4. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Coming soon, rowing's greatest rivalry, live and exclusively on Times Radio.
You've saved carefully for your future, your plans, your peace of mind. Now there's good news. FSCS protection for your savings and current accounts has risen to £120,000 per eligible person at UK authorised banks, building societies and credit unions. From the very first pound right up to £120,000, it's all protected. So you can focus on what matters with confidence. See what it means for you at fscs.org.uk. Your savings, FSCS protected.
At QuickFit, our customers drive away happy every time. Do we tell them jokes? No.
All right.
We just do our job, but don't take our word for it. Take the word of thousands of excellent customer reviews on Google and Trustpilot.
There's loads.
That's why our customers drive away happy. QuickFit, drive away happy every time.
This spring, start your own story in Scotland. Step into a land where the views are wild, the welcomes are warm, and the magic is real. From lofty mountains to vibrant cities, explore Scotland's breathtaking landscapes and uncover our ancient history. And with an exciting range of cultural events and festivals to enjoy, spring is the perfect time to plan your escape. Write your own Scottish story this spring. Start your adventure at visitscotland.com/spring.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Maggie says, that was a long discussion about the harms and costs of care, but nothing about supporting parents and helping children get home. Keep mothers with their children. Well, actually, Claire did say, didn't she, that sometimes, obviously, support is given to families, and on the whole, families need and should stay together, need to and should stay together, but it's not always possible for a multitude of reasons. None of them, all of them complicated and all kinds of experiences there. Thank you for that, though. You're always welcome to messages 0333 003 2353. Over the next couple of days, we're going to be doing some interviews to put in our happy bank here on the Times Radio Afternoon Show, because we are conscious that it's a weighty old world out there. So tomorrow, live in the studio, we've got Monty Don. Now, he's got a lovely new book. Honestly, as you know, Fee, I haven't got the greenest of fingers, but I do know that this is a beautiful book. It's called, quite simply, British Gardens.
Are we going to keep your astroturf hard standing a little bit quiet during the interview?
Neither of us have got much to boast about in those departments, so let's just keep it on the down low. But now you've said it, we've both been horribly exposed, haven't we?
Anyway, we have, yeah. Yep. We've got some right old treats, though. Pam Ayres is coming up on the show. Probably we'll put that out in a couple of weeks' time.
She's written a lovely children's book about a dormouse.
Lovely.
Yeah, it is lovely.
We've got David Soleil as well. He is the Booker Prize winning author of Flesh.
Yeah, okay.
The Male Gaze. We're going to examine that. We've got Thangam Debonair on as well. She's going to talk about the Non-Fiction Women's Prize. And Catherine Carr on her Siblings book. Yes. I know that you're fascinated by that as an older sister. I'm less fascinated as a younger one.
Yes. Anyone who thinks that birth order isn't significant,
just listen to this show.
Right. We want to thank our producer today, Hannah Quinn, technical operator. Yeah, I don't know how he does it. He doesn't know either, but it was Ryan Boyd, and we're very grateful to him. And John Pienaar is next with Drive.
Have a lovely evening.
Bye-bye.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Jane. Thank you, Fee. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar with Times Radio Drive. And here are the headlines. The US Director of National Intelligence has contradicted President Trump's justifications for war in Iran, casting doubts on that country's nuclear capability. And the University of Kent says the rollout of meningitis B vaccines for students living in halls will begin today. And coming up, the former Chief of the Defence Staff, Lord Richards, is joining me to discuss whether the UK should help Donald Trump in his efforts to reopen the Straits of Hormuz. And Times Radio's political editor, Anna Mihailova, is going to be telling us if Angela Rayner has fired a starting gun in a campaign to replace Keir Starmer.
This is Times Radio.
Now the news with Will Hobbs.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. The US Director of National Intelligence has contradicted President Trump's justifications for war in Iran. Tulsi Gabbard has told senators that an operation in June obliterated Iran's nuclear enrichment program and that Iran made no effort to rebuild its capabilities afterwards. Meanwhile, The Times' foreign correspondent Richard Spencer says Trump has clearly given up on regime change in the country, despite it being a key justification for war.
Israel, however, hasn't quite given up on it. Its view is if it does so much damage that chaos ensues, that every single leader, one after the other, is picked off, that in some way some alternative force can step in and say, OK, we are now the real government. I think you'd have to say it still doesn't look very likely, but I suppose you could argue it's possible.
Meanwhile, the Iranian president has confirmed that the intelligence minister, Esmail Khatib, has been killed in Israeli airstrikes. It happened hours after Iran's security chief, Ali Larijani, was killed in the same way. The University of Kent says the rollout of meningitis B vaccines for students living in halls will begin today. Around 5,000 are being offered the jab after an outbreak which has seen 20 cases identified and two people have died. Times Radio's Amelia Beltrau reports.
The UK Health Security Agency did declare a national incident on Sunday, but that was an operational move, meaning they could move more antibiotics to Kent. It also allowed them to bring in staff to help with a localised vaccination programme, which is due to start this afternoon.
Supporters of Shabana Mahmood have hit back at Angela Rayner after she criticised plans to make it harder for migrants already in Britain to settle permanently. The former Deputy Prime Minister described plans to apply tough new settlement rules retrospectively to foreign nationals who came to the UK in the last 5 years as un-British. She also used her speech last night to say Labour was fighting for survival and running out of time. Kemi Badenoch jumped on this in Prime Minister's questions.
The Prime Minister wants to talk about my leadership. I'm shocked because his former deputy has just fired the starting gun on the race to replace him. And I'll tell him one thing. She and I both agree that this weak man should be replaced by a strong woman.
Gerry Adams was a major, major player in the war, according to one of his former friends who was an IRA volunteer. at the High Court. Brendan Hughes was speaking in a recorded interview that was played in court to Mr. Adams. The former Sinn Féin president denies the allegations against him by three victims of bombings in England by the Provisional IRA in the 1970s and 1990s. And Senegal have vowed to fight the decision to strip them of their Africa Cup of Nations title and will launch proceedings at the Court of Arbitration for Sport. The Confederation of African Football's appeal board overturned January's 1-0 final victory as punishment for Senegal walking off the pitch in protest at a refereeing decision and awarded the match to the beaten finalists Morocco. The decision to overturn the result of the final is unprecedented in the history of major football tournaments. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app and via your smart speaker. John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive with ServiceNow.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. The meningitis outbreak doesn't have to be a pandemic or anything like one to be worrying. It isn't a pandemic, and it is worrying. And it's well worth saying there's no need for panic before bringing you the latest on the spread of the disease, the scale of the threat, and the strength of the health service response. We'll have the latest here on Drive for you in just a moment. In the Commons earlier, Keir Starmer clearly felt he was on the right side of the argument and the right side of public opinion with his refusal to be drawn into what he calls a wider war in the Middle East. Again and again, he laid into the Tory leader, Kemi Badenoch, for her initial support for joining President Trump in America's attack on Iran. Of course, that has led to an almost daily verbal attack on Starmer from a plainly furious Donald Trump, who also yesterday suggested it was time to consider leading the United States away from NATO. We're watching the president in the course of the next couple of hours for you, by the way, and we're going to keep you right up to date with, well, who knows what. And on today's show, let's talk about the war, about the rift in the UK-US relationship, and just as significantly, the way European and other leaders are moving further away from America and dividing among themselves as the war goes on and the energy crisis deepens. Now, what is your view on whether Starmer is striking the right balance between avoiding an escalating war in the Middle East and managing the relationship with America, which may suddenly look rather less special, but which is nonetheless vital? Tell me what you think. Send me a text, 87222. Start with the word Times or a tweet to @TimesRadio. First, though, meningitis. The meningitis B vaccines will be offered to all students living on the University of Kent's Canterbury campus from today. Two people have died after a so-called super spreader event in a Kent nightclub. And the UK Health Security Agency has confirmed another 20 people have been confirmed with meningitis. Eleanor Haywood is here with me in the studio. Welcome to you, Eleanor.
Hi.
Thank you for joining us. Can you just give us the latest on the spread of the disease and the condition of the sufferers?
Yeah, we received an update this morning from the UK Health Security Agency of another 5 cases. So that takes the total to 20. And of those, we know that 2 have died and the remainder are in hospital. In terms of other developments, then, this afternoon, students at the University of Kent began receiving the meningitis B vaccine. It's a bit of an emergency rollout to 5,000 students there. And that the hope is that that will stop them getting ill down the line if there are further outbreaks, although it doesn't provide sort of immediate protection.
And we can say, Eleanor, that we are dealing with a purely local outbreak of this disease.
Yeah, there is no concern at the moment of it spreading further around the country. Just because of the nature of meningitis, you have to have very close, prolonged contact with an infected person to be at risk. So it's not the sort of thing that spreads from being on a train with someone or being in the same room as someone. It's things like kissing, sharing drinks, sharing vapes. And in this case, it was that in a nightclub where you're obviously in close contact with people as well. So there's no sort of fear of a really huge outbreak beyond those who were exposed in Kent.
Okay, so as I say, no need for panic in the obvious sense. And how well, tell us, is the NHS response keeping pace?
I think it's been slightly mixed. There's been some criticism about the delay between people falling ill.